You're listening to Greater LA. It's KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiatakis. At a skate park in downtown Santa Barbara, right next to the ocean, a dozen tiny masked crusaders wheel down a cement slope. 9-year-old Aiden McNellis lists off his favorite terrain.
Oh yeah, the bowl, slash huff pipe, the monster. And then I named this like series of ramps where you go down from the other edge over the tabletop and then you go over there.
Aiden and about a dozen other kids are part of the first wave of this summer's campers. And they're lucky. Some camps decided not to reopen this summer. Some went totally virtual. Others are going bankrupt. But especially those that meet outdoors, they're trying to make it work. 11-year-old Sophia Imhoff says she signed up for skate camp for a couple of reasons.
I wanted to get over my irrational fear of ramps, and also my mom said we had to get out of the house.
Many parents are thrilled to have a place to drop their kids off for the day after being cooped up with them for months. But that sigh of relief comes with a pit in their stomach. With coronavirus cases continuing to climb in California, is summer camp safe? Here's KCRW's Catherine Barnes.
It's 9 a.m., drop-off time. Alex Saunders was supposed to stay in his car, as he and the other parents had been asked to. But it's his 10-year-old son Connor's second day at nature camp, and he wants to make sure he knows where he's going. I asked Saunders what made him decide to send his kid to camp this year, as the rate of coronavirus cases in California continues to hit new highs.
It is a debate every morning, because on one hand, he's been inside for 3 months, unable to play with his friends, and has been literally locked inside with his parents, which is the greatest torture you can think of. That being said, the increasing numbers are hugely concerning, and I don't know if it's good to send him to camp or not. I just know what's best for him is probably going to camp. What's best for everyone else, including myself, I don't know.
So, for camps that are opening to campers in person, how are they going about it safely? After drop-off, Connor and several dozen other kids filter into a grassy field. They're told to sit inside a colorful hula hoop, each spaced 6 feet apart. They start by singing some silly warm-up songs. Then the campers are split off into their pods, groups of 9 kids and 1 counselor. Adam Porte is the camp supervisor. He says these pods make a big difference in both preventing and tracing the spread of the coronavirus, if it does hit the camp.
Each group is, quote unquote, a household, and so we can't let those households mix, and so that's the way we're looking at it.
Nature camp is usually filled with field trips to hiking trails, batting cages, and parks. But this year, Porte says squishing 15 kids into a van is not going to happen. They're limiting the van capacity to 5 kids at a time, 1 in each row.
Yeah, and we are asking the kids to wear their mask if possible.
All the kids were given a lime green bandana on their first day of camp. Some kids are wearing it around their faces and noses, but most have dropped them down to their necks. Porte says even though not everyone wears their mask properly, most kids understand the importance of staying a safe distance away from their friends.
It's definitely tough, but I do have to say that I think that these kids have been really well conditioned already by their parents, and they're really good at following directions. So I think the kids all know the importance of the safety and like why we're doing it. So it's actually pretty remarkable how good the kids are at it.
Porte is right. Talking to Aiden and Sophia down the road at skate camp, they seem to understand the role they play in how the coronavirus can spread.
No, like, the younger you are, the more, the less symptoms thing, but, like, they can transmit it like
what
crazy.
What a lot of people don't realize is if you're not immune, that's great, you're immune, but you can still, like, it's not going to hurt you. You can still get it. You can be a carrier. It's not the danger of you getting it necessarily. It's the danger of you giving it to somebody who could suffer from it.
That's the fear among parents, counselors, and staff responsible for these camps. Could more kids playing together lead to an uptick in cases, hospitalizations, and even deaths? Rich Hanna is the recreation manager for the Santa Barbara Parks and Recreation Department. That's his biggest concern.
You know, I've been with the department 27 years, and we've dealt with things like red tides and shark sightings and jellyfish and stingray incidences at the beach. We've dealt with lice in camps before. But this has really been a test. I'd like to think that we make it all the way through the summer with no incidences. But every night I go to bed and I'm watching the latest cases in Santa Barbara County. And every morning when I get up really early, I'm watching anything that's being updated as of my staff.
He says one parent, kid, or counselor testing positive for COVID-19 could shut a pod or an entire camp down for the rest of the summer. He's asking families and counselors to self-monitor their symptoms and avoid camp if they feel sick. But some other camps are taking extra safety precautions, especially in Los Angeles, which currently leads the U.S. in coronavirus cases. Star Camps is based in L.A. and offers a range of activities for kids in the summer, as well as after-school programs during the school year. Typically, they pop up all over L.A., but this summer they're offering in-person camps at only two locations, both on the west side. The rest are online only. Sir Robinson is the director of innovation for STAR.
It's definitely not ideal, but nothing about this summer is ideal when you're dealing with something like this. You know, we're happy that we could offer anything at this point. A lot of our competitors weren't even able to do that.
This summer, young Angelinos heading to a STAR camp get their temperature checked twice every day. Counselors get checked too. Plus, they have to submit a negative COVID-19 test before starting their assignment. And both camps in LA and Santa Barbara require parents to sign a waiver releasing the camps of any liability related to contracting the virus. As the director of innovation, Robinson had to get especially innovative this year. He says when the kids go inside for an activity, they're separated from one another with 6-foot-tall clear partitions.
So basically, the campers are in their own cubicle, and they get to decorate this workstation and work in that cubicle part of the day. The rest of the day, they're outside having fun and enjoying some fresh air. But when they're inside, they're in these cubicles for added safety.
Temperature checks, hand sanitizer, pods, personal hula hoops, masks. Robinson says in a lot of ways, summer camp is the first step in preparing kids for what they'll experience at school in the fall, if that is they're allowed back into their classrooms.
A lot of the protocol that I've mentioned today that we've implemented will also be implemented in schools whenever they do reopen for the safety of the children. So this is a great time for the kids to get ready for that new normal in a few months.
Back at skate camp in Santa Barbara, 11-year-old Valentina Thomas says all of this added safety is worth it if it means she gets to spend the summer making new friends.
For me, it doesn't feel like summer not having much interaction without your brother or your parents around you. Without like the summer camps and stuff, I mean, that's kind of what makes the summer for us.
As camp winds down for the day, Andrew Saunders is back to pick up his son. Now, he has to worry about how to get any potential germs off of Connor before he comes inside the house.
The routine is, they come on home, they scrub everything, everything gets put away, everybody gets their hands washed, and we go about it, but I don't know if that's enough or not.
He says he wants to err on the side of caution, but he also doesn't want to keep Connor locked up. Plus, his son likes the silly songs and games and being with kids his own age. It takes his mind off things. So for tomorrow, at least, he'll be heading back to camp. For KCRW, I'm Catherine Barnes.
Fourth verse.
Same as the first.
Same as the first.
But a little bit weirder and a whole lot worse.
A little bit weirder.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Onward now with KCRW's Greater LA. Glad you joined us. In recent weeks, there have been many calls to dismantle or drastically reduce funding for the police. The Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department is the nation's largest sheriff's department, overseeing more than 150 unincorporated areas and more than 40 cities in the county. It also does courthouse security, and it handles all inmate transport in and out of county jails. But the department is facing big cuts, not because of protests, but because of a large budget shortfall this year. That obviously plays into the future of a department that is also embroiled in several controversies at the moment. Those include the killing of an 18-year-old Salvadoran American security guard in Gardena, Andres Guardado, and the killing of Taron Boone, the brother of the black man who'd been found hanged from a tree in Palmdale. Boone was shot by L.A. County Sheriff's deputies outside their jurisdiction in Kern County during what they described as a shootout with them after giving chase. Celeste Freeman is the founder and editor of Witness LA. She's been covering law enforcement for a long time here in LA. Celeste, welcome.
It's good to be here, Steve.
The Sheriff's Department is different, obviously, from the LAPD. What are the basic differences, Celeste, between the two departments?
Well, the Sheriff's Department actually has, you know, a much larger budget than the LAPD and, you know, has not really had it slashed. But they're probably not only the largest Sheriff's Department in the nation, they're the most complicated because of all they have to do in terms of most specifically running the jails. But the list of other things that you mentioned, plus they become the law enforcement department for loads of cities in Los Angeles County. They're contract cities. So it's a very complex department to run. And right now, it's got a lot of people and justice advocates really feeling there need to be big changes in the department. And an angry sheriff who seems to point at everybody else as being at fault.
I want to talk about some of these controversies, though, that I mentioned at the outset, Celeste. First of all, the killing of 18-year-old Andres Guardado. He was shot on June 18th by a sheriff's deputy. As of last week, the department put a security hold on the case. It's blocking the release of the autopsy report, saying that, quote, investigators wish to maintain the integrity of the investigation and premature release of information could jeopardize the case. Is that standard procedure? Because there are a lot of questions about that case.
Well, there have been a number of opinions about whether that's really standard procedure. But with this case of this young man, it's really gotten Los Angeles County community members really upset because he was someone who was putting himself through school. He was very well liked by the people that he was an unofficial security guard. And there didn't seem to be any reason on earth why this kid would end up dead. The deputies involved said that there was a gun, and it's, you know, it's sort of the gun from the crime novel with the filed off serial numbers. It may be all on the up and up and just a terrible tragedy, but it just feels bad to just about everybody who feels, you know, who hears about it. And an outside investigation has been called in with a motion by Supervisor Mark Ridley Thomas, and that made the sheriff really mad. It was a read-in motion that it was at the last minute in the last board meeting, and the sheriff was mad as a hornet that the supervisor would do that.
Do we know, Celeste, how long that the autopsy report can be blocked? Can they do it for a long period of time, indefinitely? When are we going to know? Because that autopsy report is going to tell us where he was shot and from what direction he was shot.
Yeah, I you know, to be perfectly honest, I don't know the answer to that question. But it's another thing that it's hard to understand why that would be necessary. Perhaps it's more usual than we think, but this is just not the sort of thing that is normally called to our attention, and it doesn't feel good to the people who are concerned about why and how this shooting took place. So even if it's just the optics, it doesn't look good. And the shooting of Robert Fuller's half-brother, Taron Boone, was shot and killed by members of the sheriff's department. And he allegedly had sort of gone off the rails and had kidnapped his girlfriend and was holding her. But in any case, he didn't, as one attorney I talked to said, he didn't deserve to die for that. But that shooting has a lot of problematic elements. But one of them is that there was a woman in the car with him who was injured by shrapnel and a seven-year-old girl. And this is, it seems like a small thing, but they took the seven-year-old girl into the station and held her for quite some time and questioned her for reportedly a long period, but they would not allow any family members to be present with this seven-year-old girl.
Do you believe that there will be consequences, Celeste, for the officer-involved killings of Andres Guardado or of Taryn Boone and other controversies within the department, given the environment we're in right now?
I think that there very likely could be, particularly with Andres Guardado. I think with Taryn Boone, it's a lot more complicated, but there still needs to be a good, hard look at that situation and how it played out. And there are going to be some high-ticket lawsuits, and they're already in motion on at least one of those and probably both. And reading the complaint is painful.
A lot of folks across the country, Celeste, are calling for reform, changes to policing. How do you think all those calls will affect LASD, if at all? Do you think that's affecting the Sheriff's Department as well?
All the attention has been on the LAPD, so the push for reform over there has been a lot louder and sooner. But the LASD, the Sheriff's Department, has almost three times the budget and affects a vast area of Los Angeles. I mean, it's, you know, it's covering Los Angeles County. And I think that pressure is definitely ramping up and has been there for quite some time. So some of these battles, like the one over subpoenas and quite a number of other things, I think are going to heat up a great deal when it comes to the Sheriff's Department.
Why do you think all the attention, though, has been on LAPD and not on the Sheriff's Department?
Well, yeah, the LASD has had scandal after scandal, but I think with these protests, we suddenly saw a bunch of really bad behavior by the LAPD as they were pepper spraying, tear gassing, and shooting with these rubber bullets, non-lethal projectiles, peaceful protesters, and the odd journalist, which, you know, I mean, It was very distressing to see that Chief Mike Morin seemed to not to be controlling his troops. So the attention went there, and rightly so. But it's, I think now it's, there's a lot of attention on the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department.
But, you know, Celeste, though, the LASD doesn't operate in a vacuum. I mean, it has seen all kinds of scandals over the years.
Well, it's been a scandal factory and a lawsuit factory. But I think that right now it has been the pressure on the LAPD, and I think that's about to turn to a lot more pressure on our county agency, the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department. And we're seeing it with these troubling deaths.
Celeste Freeman, the founder and editor of Witness LA. Celeste, thanks for your time. We appreciate it.
Yeah, pleasure to be here, Steve.
It's Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Let's head to Orange County. There's a lively debate playing out on the streets and inside county chambers about a famous cowboy actor in the airport that bears his name.
Now, we'll all calm down.
Boss, he's just a little excited.
I know. I'm going to use good judgment. I haven't lost my temper in 40 years. But Pilgrim, you caused a lot of trouble this morning. Might have got somebody killed. And somebody ought to belt you in the mouth. But I won't. I won't. The hell I won't.
Oh, John Wayne was among the top box office draws for three decades, famous for his tough guy roles in Western films. You just heard one right there. But Democrats in OC want Wayne's name and likeness removed from the Orange County Airport in Santa Ana. They're citing racist statements that he made in an interview with Playboy magazine back in 1971. Here's a CNN host reading one of Wayne's quotes from that interview.
"I believe in white supremacy until the blacks are educated to a point of responsibility."
That was Michael Smirkanish on CNN. Gustavo Arellano writes for the LA Times. He's here with KCRW's Orange County line. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
So let's talk about this. Why is the airport named after John Wayne in the first place?
Because in 1979, shortly after John Wayne passed away, the Orange County Board of Supervisors, which made no beef about how much they idolized John Wayne, they named it in his honor. John Wayne had been living in Newport Beach for about 14 years, and Orange County felt so proud that the greatest American of them all, John Wayne, was an Orange County man himself. So Thomas Riley, the head of the Board of chair of the Board of Supervisors at the time, legendary figure in Orange County politics, he went on the record that saying that John Wayne is an American hero, and this is why we're naming our airport, which before that was just known as Orange County Airport. This is why we're naming it after the Duke.
What else did he say in that interview with Playboy? I mean, was that the most controversial part of what he said?
Oh, for the Playboy interview, my lord. I actually have a copy of it, one of those Playboy interview anthologies, and he's just going off against Angela Davis, against Indians, saying that, you know, he believes in welfare, but that you should be working to go to welfare. He also admitted that when he was going to USC in the 1920s, that he was a socialist, but he grew up. It actually is a great interview. And even at the time, it was controversial because everyone knew, okay, John Wayne, anti-communist, anti-liberal, anti-everything. But he's coming out with really harsh language against African-Americans and Native Americans. And this is, what, 1971. So legendary interview, but for in many ways, at least in the present day, all the wrong reasons.
I guess you really are one of the people who reads Playboy for the articles.
So, you know what? I was one of the very few people who did. If I needed to see certain things, I would have other magazines to see them in.
John Wayne died decades ago, as we mentioned. He's not here to defend himself or defend the words from that interview from many, many years ago in Playboy magazine. But we do have his son, Ethan Wayne, who came to his father's defense last year when this debate surfaced. And he says the quotes were taken out of context. Let's hear from Ethan Wayne.
"Any discussion of removing his name from the airport should include the full picture of the life of John Wayne and not be based on a single outlier interview from half a century ago."
What do you think?
Oh, come on, Ethan. It's not an outlier interview. If you know your Playboy interviews, these take time over days, hours. I mean, the John Wayne interview that I have in front of me is 20 pages. All that said, though, I will say John Wayne, it's easy to cast him as a complete unabashed racist, but the complexities of John Wayne's life is even more particular to Orange County. So Ethan Wayne, half Peruvian because his mother was Peruvian. John Wayne married nothing but Latinas. John Wayne's son-in-law, Gregory Munoz, he was the first Chicano judge in Orange County. And John Wayne's grandson, Matthew Munoz, who is Gregory's son, he's a prominent priest in Orange County. So can John Wayne be truly racist if his children are half Latino and his grandchildren, a lot of them are three quarters Latino?
Do you think this debate's going to fizzle, Gustavo? Do you think this is just going to go away?
No, it's not going to go away, because as long as the Board of Supervisors is dominated by Republicans, they're going to keep that John Wayne name. This will continue until there's finally a Democratic majority on the Board of Supervisors. And frankly, what I would tell the Democratic Party is, like, don't stop with John Wayne. John Wayne is one thing. If you really want to rename something, rename the Thomas Riley Airport. So Thomas Riley, that supervisor who was such a fanboy of John Wayne, he was a supervisor also during the Orange County bankruptcy of 1994. That's a bigger sin than something that John Wayne said 50 some years ago to the heart of Orange County.
What do you think, Gustavo? You think John Wayne's name should be on that airport? You're a lifelong Orange Countyan.
You know, yes and no. On one hand, I don't think it should be named John Wayne because we shouldn't be naming it after a celebrity. Just call it Orange County Airport. But on the other hand, you know me, I love the schadenfreude. I love the embarrassment that comes with Orange County still having its name, its airport named after John Wayne, because we should always remember this is what Orange County used to be. We're not that anymore. And even what we are now, it still includes John Wayne's half Latino family. So it's always about the complexities. But if it gets renamed, hey, the man who shot Liberty Valance, when the legend becomes fact, just change the legend.
A lot of layers to this one, Gustavo. Gustavo Arellano with this week's KCRW Orange County Line. Gustavo, thanks.
Gracias.
So what do you think? Should Orange County nix the name of the Duke for the airport? If so, what name would you give it? Share your thoughts with us at kcrw.com/askgreaterla. You can also subscribe to the podcast, too, at our website, kcrw.com/greaterla. We're watching some news from L.A. County's Public Health Department today, out with an urgent warning that the number of coronavirus cases in the county and hospitalizations are increasing at alarming rates. Those are their words, and that hospital beds could be full in the matter of a couple of weeks. We're watching those numbers. We'll have more on the current spike in the coming days. That's it for us today. Tomorrow, an update from the Antelope Valley on the investigation into the death of Robert Fuller, the man found hanged from a tree in Palmdale. Funeral services are tomorrow. We'll be there. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, Amy Ta, Mario Saavedra, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Paul Smith, Christine Comito, and Christian Bordahl all made this show happen today. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for your ears and attention. Please stay safe and have a good night.